Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable for this 20th of October. It is Friday. It's hard to believe that we started the week with a fun drive, and well, that ended Tuesday morning, but no, we've had the rest of the week. But we finished off, and we're done, and it's great, and we're here, and we thank you very, very much for being with us this morning. My goodness, we have quite a panel for you and quite a show and quite some opportunities to talk about interesting issues with very, very interesting individuals. Let me go around the table here and introduce them all. Teresa Bourgeois is here. She is a communications consultant, and we welcome her to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Delighted to be here on such a beautiful day.
It was a pretty day.
Wow.
It is. The colors are beautiful. It was sunny. We had a lovely ride in. Aaron, you had a similar ride, I assume, coming in from Cambridge. It was beautiful,
wasn't
it?
Yes, it was gorgeous. And we get the meteor shower tonight.
That's right. It's perfect. Absolutely
perfect.
Wait,
you guys are neighbors?
We are neighbors.
Hmm. Is that right? Did you know each other before?
No.
No.
Wow.
No.
That's terrific. Although, I mean, chances. Cambridge is not
although,
that big of a
neighbors in Cambridge could mean like 5 or 6 miles away, yeah. So...
Yeah, that's right. We're, you know, with this cow separating us. Although, since knowing each other, then we do bump into each other at the brewery a lot.
Over to the
brewery. Yeah,
over
a lot.
To the brewery.
Over to the brewery. Emphasis on a lot. Yeah. Like every day.
I know
but it's
where,
not a
depending
problem.
What's going on in the world.
I know where to find him. He knows where to find me. Yeah. We're all good.
As long as it's refillable bottles, I'm fine with that.
Absolutely, 100%.
Yes.
And by the way, Aaron Pacitti is a professor of economics at Siena College, and I want to give your proper title there. So, well, to give you your due, but also so the people at Siena don't yell at me.
Thank you.
And they're already
I and they appreciate that.
Well, look who's back. Oh, we missed you. My God, we missed you. Although you were nice enough to call us, and we thank you very, very much for that. While you were out saving the world, we missed you horribly, but you are back and still saving the world, and we thank you for that. Judith Ank is here. She is a former EPA regional administrator. She was spending some time in the Virgin Islands trying to make things a little more right there. And how you doing?
I'm great. I'm really happy to be back. And I want to thank WAMC listeners who, during the fund drive, I'm told, supported solar lanterns going to Puerto Rico, which is really fantastic. So thank you. And I coincidentally am working to get about 2,500 solar lanterns over to the U.S. Virgin Islands. So we've got that in motion. But really appreciate that support from WAMC.
Well, thank you. It's we'll hear some stories from you.
Sure.
We got some stories on here to talk about what you've been up to, and we'll get to that in a few moments. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir. Nice to have you.
Good morning. I can't tell you how many people were coming up to me in the street, Big Joe, and saying, you know, it's I met a couple that's even older than I am, which is hard to believe. And they came up to me in the street and they said, we run the radio every morning. We don't want to miss the roundtable.
Wow.
That's lovely.
Yeah. Community.
Well, community, and it was really all was lovely to see. And as I said in the introduction, it's hard to believe that's how we started out the week, and now here we are. It didn't last long.
Yeah, Judith, there are a lot of people who want you to run for Congress. Have you already said no to that?
I've repeatedly said no. Thank you, Alan.
You're embarrassing me once again.
But I know this will surprise you, maybe even shock you, but our listeners. Really want your friend.
Yeah, well, they're all my relatives. So, Helen, Jacqueline, stop calling.
All right. We have a lot to talk about and try to figure out what's happening in our world. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. I know I say that a lot if we try to figure out what's happening in our world. I don't know that we're ever going to accomplish that, but we can try. We can every day, we can just chip away and try to figure out what's happening in our world. So where to begin? We will go to this is my stall tactic of trying to get my
vamp until ready.
Well, that's right. So there's I have the little that little dreaded.
We can sing.
I'll
do it again.
We can encourage people to go and listen to the recording with Paul Ryan from last night.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
A good laugh.
You know, it was very, he was funny. The words were funny. I mean, I thought he was a little stiff himself, but the words were very funny. And
well, he's kind of stiff, right?
What'd you say?
He is kind of stiff, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, no, he's stiff. Yeah.
Genetically.
Mortuary.
But he had a good writer.
But
so, Alan,
but,
tell everybody where he was.
At the Al Smith dinner, you know, this is a once-a-year dinner in which people are supposed to make fun of each other. But everything he said wasn't funny. It was laughable, but accurate. I mean, he made jokes about he wakes up in the morning in his office, which is interesting because I think it means he sleeps in his office. He's one of those guys who sleeps in his office. So,
which I don't think is very hygienic. I just want to add.
Well, a lot of them do.
I know, to save money and make a point.
Yeah, make a point to their congresspeople.
I worry about their grooming.
They live back in the district, right. But there's so much alcohol in so many of those offices that it's a great disinfectant. And when you get to Washington.
So much alcohol.
What? Are you talking like bottles of scotch?
Well, there's receptions.
When I worked in Congress, Cutty Sark. I'll never forget Cutty Sark. And the congressman said to me, now your job is going to be bartender, and that's going to allow you to be, I was an intern, that's going to allow you to be in on all the conversations because you'll be the thing. Now, he had a secretary or an administrator named Faye, and he said, now you pour Faye a bourbon and pour me a Cutty Sark. So I went over there. I took two big glasses. I'm used to Pepsi Cola, so I fill both glasses up to the top. Well, they laughed so hard I thought it was going to.
Yeah,
go
we like you as a bartender.
Did they tip well at that point?
Yeah, an excellent role for an intern.
Yes, absolutely.
Have I, by the way, satisfied you?
I'm still having issues, but I do. Teresa was nice enough to give me the. Well, thank you very much. Everyone helping me here. John Kelly, General Kelly, yesterday, the White House Chief of Staff, delivered a personal defense of President Trump's phone call this week to the widow of a slain Army soldier, describing on Thursday the trauma of learning about his own son's death in Afghanistan and calling the criticism of Mr. Trump's condolences unfair. I've watched the tape a couple of times. Mm. I find it really interesting because, first of all, there were a couple of little swipes there at the president of saying, well, the president said it in his own way and in that president's way of, in other words, sort of ham-handed, I think. Yeah.
But saying,
that's the problem. He's saying it in his own way.
But saying his intentions were good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No matter what came out of his mouth, his intentions were good.
And then the sort of jump the shark moment for me was then going after the congresswoman,
right,
which I was surprised about because first of all, I think some of the things that were missing in the context of that conversation is that the congresswoman was a friend of the family. She was in the car and they were driving to the service.
She was invited to listen.
To receive the body.
Yeah.
And she knew the fallen soldier.
She not only did she know him,
she was the principal of the school with his father. Mm-hmm. I mean, it went back to his father.
Yeah.
So they were saying that, and here's the thing that, this is basically what I want to ask the panel, because he kept on talking about how it was they were politicizing this, but it was the president of the United States who brought up John Kelly's son. Mm-hmm. It was the president of the United States who brought up he makes phone calls, other presidents didn't. So I don't know. That doesn't ring true to me. Yes, Alan.
Thank you. I held up my hand. I just want to say that I can't even imagine what the back and forth in the White House was getting Kelly to go and do that, because he doesn't like to be out front and he doesn't like to do it. So obviously they sort of, you know, pushed
strong
on him.
Arm.
However, I have to tell you, and I'm not a fan of this president, as I think people who listen will know. I think it was a helpful move to the president.
Right. It was helpful until the president tweeted late last night. I mean, I think what Kelly was trying to do was, you know, have some calm and some respect and some dignity around this very somber issue. And I thought his presentation was very poignant until he went after Congresswoman Wilson. And my guess is the way they probably convinced him to do it was that, let's put a lid on this, let's move on. Mm-hmm. And then late last night, President Trump did another really disrespectful, zany tweet on this very topic.
At 10:53 last night, the president tweeted, "The fake news is going crazy with wacky Congresswoman Wilson."
Right.
Mm-hmm. D,
mm-hmm.
as he
said. A woman.
Who, by the way, a woman, and also happens to be black.
And who said was...
Okay, I just want to finish that last thought. Right. Last thought. I'm sorry, Joe. Happens to be black and is a continuation of the Trump going to the base and holding blacks in contempt, which is what his whole style is. It's how he won the last time and how he expects to win this time.
So the part of the tweet is that the fake news is going crazy with wacky Congresswoman Wilson, who was secretly, all caps, secretly on a very personal call and gave a total lie on content. Okay, so the two parts of that. One is secretly was you called the car phone and they were on speakerphone, so that's not really secret, number one. Number two, if you are then calling the congresswoman a liar, you are then also calling the widow a liar because she said exactly the same thing and corroborated that those were the words spoken.
Right. Actually, I think it was her aunt.
I apologize.
Who raised her?
Yes, the aunt. So to your point, so why? I'm sorry. It was your point actually that Judith that leaving well enough alone until 10:53.
Right, bring it back again. I have to believe that John Kelly is not happy this morning because he put a lot on the line going out, speaking publicly about his deceased son, which he's never spoken publicly before. He really, I think, did this to defend Trump. I mean, my other major point is that when I was listening to the explanation where General Kelly talked about when General Dempsey delivered the news of his terrible, tragic loss and explained kind of the messaging he used, that your son died. He knew what he was signing up for, essentially. He died with his friends. He died doing what he wanted to do. I think Trump tried to mimic that message, but was not capable of delivering that message in a compassionate, empathetic way. And the point is that, remember, Trump said that the Congresswoman Wilson lied, that this was not what he said. But I thought Kelly was kind of explaining to us why Trump said what he said.
He also, Aaron, it seemed to me that he also defended President Obama as well in his remarks, because it had been, he was saying that it is sometimes in these mass casualties, it is not the role of a president to do that, and that he had been treated very fairly and sort of came out and made that statement too.
And doesn't it seem to the rest of you that what he's doing here indicates that he's in real, he felt he was in real trouble, that he had to push
Kelly
that he
out.
Had to push Kelly out there to do this. I'm sorry, Teresa, you were going to say.
I think the fundamental problem here is that this is a Gold Star family. And what's happened since the call is that they shifted from the focus on the family to the focus on Trump as a victim. It really doesn't matter how President Trump feels or anyone else feels in this situation. What we all should be focused on is what the family feels. And if they misunderstood, well, then why didn't the president just come out and say, "I'm sorry if they misunderstood. This is what I intended to say."
Or call again.
What we do is care deeply about this family, and we want to help them in any way that we can, as well as the other four families. And that would have been that. But what happened is, and he and, the stuff that the White House has been saying around this, the pushback is just, the problem is the pushback. And in fact, the family, I think they sounded like they were more upset, not about, what he said about, he knew he was going in there, but that the president didn't even appear to know his name. Mm-hmm. And that's what the aunt who raised him said, that, that they felt uncomfortable because he didn't even appear to know the name of their family member. But I thought that the Military Times, I thought, let's see what they're saying about this. And they have this daily thing, they call it medals and misfires. And they gave them a misfire, and the reason they gave them a misfire is because of forcing General Kelly to talk about his son, that you should not have politicized this.
Which he did.
Which he was complaining about.
Yeah, right.
You know, the irony here is that Kelly called Congresswoman Wilson a publicity-seeking opportunist.
Wow.
And that is,
talk about who's saying what.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
And also,
and sad.
Because the woman is doing her job. The woman, not only as a friend doing her job, but also as a representative of a family of a fallen soldier in her district.
That's what Congress members do.
That's what they do.
Yeah.
And they're there for support and to help get them through a very, very rough time when in any way that they can. I don't know.
Also, Joe, it was, remember when the call was made? It was made on the way to pick up the body.
Oh, my gosh.
So they knew they had to do something fast. Otherwise, I don't think he would have called the car.
Right. And we have to go to a break. But then the other thing I want to talk about when we come back is just the fact that it took so long in the first place. I mean, let's talk about that.
We're losing sight of the core issues here, of the profiles of these four people, and what were they doing there, and how can we help their families?
We'll get to all of that, I promise, right after we come back from a break. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We already have a couple of letters. We'll get to more in just a moment. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Ank, Aaron Pasitti, and Teresa Bourgeois making up the group this morning. We will get to letters in just a second. You were making a point right before we went to break, Teresa, about losing sight of what's really important here.
Right. I think that we really have to focus on the family and realize that they are burying a husband, a father, essentially a son. He was raised by his aunt. His mother passed away, a dear friend. And this whole episode is, they are going through the worst thing possible. And this layer of stress has been added on, which I think is just unfathomable. And what really we need to focus on is he and four other Americans were killed. They leave behind, like Staff Sergeant Brian Black of Washington State, he leaves behind a wife and two children. Staff Sergeant Jeremiah Johnson, Springboro, Ohio, he leaves behind a wife and two daughters. Staff Sergeant Dustin Wright, 29, Lyons, Fort Bragg. His family, they've been in, his family members in military service back to 1812. He leaves behind a girlfriend and a grieving parents. And then LaDavid Johnson, Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, 25, leaves behind a wife, two children, and his wife is 6 months pregnant. I mean, that's what we have to focus on. What can we do for these families? This isn't about the White House or politics or Donald Trump. This is about these Gold Star families, and that's what we have to focus on. Separately, on the policy side, we need to focus on what were they doing in Niger?
Mm-hmm.
Why did it take so long? Maybe it's explainable, maybe it's not. Why did they get picked up by a contract helicopter? You know, what was a contract helicopter doing in there? And one of the, Dustin Wright, his brother, says, it's a war zone. Even if you don't hear about it on TV, they were fighting in a war zone.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on in Niger? And can't we just leave this family alone and let them grieve privately?
Mm. Well said.
And the interesting thing is John McCain here. Mm. Because, you know, I think there are some things that become too obscure for a lot of people. They just don't get it. They don't really understand whether it's being politicized or not. But when John McCain, who has more credibility, I think, than anybody in the United States Senate, and is the head of the relevant committee, says, you know, I'm going to subpoena this because I'm not happy with the answers that we're getting, then all of a sudden it rises to the top of a lot of people's antennas.
Right.
And you had General Mattis. They must be nervous because General Mattis came out yesterday and said, you know, this is under investigation. An investigative process is standard, which, of course, anytime military officers are killed, there's a review, an investigation, and that we'll get you those answers. We'll get you the timeline. We'll tell you why this contract company was in there. Contract helicopters? What is that? Maybe
exactly.
Maybe that's standard, but Malcolm, you know, if you're listening, tell us, is that standard or anybody listening?
Well, it's not unusual. A large part of the military operation has been contracted out to private contractors. So I wouldn't be surprised about that. I think,
but
the
with no protection. Though.
Yeah, it needs to be investigated for sure. And I think the sort of the odd thing is that no one in the White House for 12 days, I believe, said anything. This is the greatest loss of life of a military operation since President Trump became president. And he has a lot to say about a lot of things. Right. And it was radio silence on this one.
Right. Until they were pressured to talk about these
by
folks.
Reporters.
And, you know, what?
But 10 days is a long time.
It's a really long time.
Right.
And, you know, what's going on in Yemen? I keep saying that. What are we doing in Yemen? And what are the Saudis doing in, you know, with there's a genocide going on in Yemen. And what is or isn't the U.S. role in that? There is, you look at Raqqa. And yes, we drove ISIS out of Raqqa, but left it in rubbles and killing many, many, many civilians because of the stepped up bombing in the last couple of months. So we have gone in and destroyed Raqqa and other parts of Syria. And now it's in the Soviet, Russian hands, excuse me. And Iran walked away from the deal. And now China's come in there.
This is when you
what are we doing?
This is when you need a strong State Department, and this is at a time when Rex Tillerson is taking the State Department apart, slashing its budget, and not having key diplomatic posts filled. You know, that this is a moment in time where diplomacy is crucial, and it's not like we have the A team at the State Department addressing these issues.
And Turkey, you know, key to our bases, Qatar. Key to our bases in the Middle East in that region.
I mean,
and
Aaron, a lot of Trump supporters were happy seeing that there's going to be a businessman in office finally. Well, that's fine and good, except when it comes to foreign policy and diplomacy.
And domestic policy.
And domestic policy and even economic policy. So, completely unqualified. And that's why we see the breakdown of the State Department and diplomacy and, you know, these messes in other countries. And it's...
I take it a little differently than you guys do. I think Tillerson, while he is learning on the job, is capable of learning. And I think when he called his boss, the president, a moron, it was an indication that he was being told to do things he didn't want to be doing. Mm-hmm. And that, for example, the decapitating, if that's the right word, of the State Department and the fact that he doesn't have the people to work with that he needs becomes very important. Look, he's used to being the top dog. Was it Exxon?
Oh, yes.
Exxon.
A very polluting company.
And when he said something, everybody genuflected. I mean, that's what it was. And here, which is one of the reasons never to be in the cabinet, because the president really is the boss, and he tells you what to do. And I think the fact that they don't have enough people and that they don't have enough budget and that you have a wild man who is talking about trying to pick a fight with the North Koreans, this is – and when it's clear that Tillerson has made himself clear that he wants to have negotiation. So I think Tillerson is not – to me, Tillerson's not the real problem here. I think his problem is he's got to listen to the president, and he has two choices: stay or go.
The other thing General Kelly said yesterday that I do think is really, really important, and Alan, I agree with you on that. But he talked about the fact that such a small percentage of our population serves in the military, and that most people really don't understand the sacrifice that our military families are going through. And I think that's true. And you think about the fact that yesterday, I know we'll get to this, but the parameters of the budget bill passed. And, you know, in that is an outline of possible cuts to military housing stipends. There are cuts to daycare for the military folks. And so if you want to support and respect our military families, yes, all of us need to understand that repeated deployments, this is terrible strain on these families to understand what's going on in their lives, but also understand what kind of, at the same time, dramatic increases in the defense budget, those are going not to people.
Right.
But to
Boeing and Northrop Grumman. I don't support cuts to child care and housing, but the military budget is bloated.
It's
and
bloated, it's about, but not for people.
Right.
It's and bloated for...
They can cut a few B-1 bombers and a few weapon systems and practically balance the budget.
Yeah, what is one of those friend. Bombers... What are one of those bombers cost?
A lot.
$14 quadrillion dollars.
Your price may vary, but yes, they cost a lot. Let's take a break. When we come back, we have a lot of letters, and then we have a lot of other issues to get to, so we want to get that. But we'll take a break. We'll be right back. And we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Pasitti, and Teresa Bourgeois making up the panel. We welcome you as well, panel at WAMC.org. We have a fistful of letters, and we begin now.
Okay, Leslie writes, Kelly, I was stunned when I heard Kelly speak. I thought finally he was resigning. But instead, he defended Trump for politicizing the death of his son, lied about Representative Wilson, and also showed some racism on his own. He is not the honorable man I once thought. That's from Leslie. And Susan says, is it just me, or is pointing out that the deceased soldier, quote, knew what he was getting into, extremely insensitive at such a time? I suspect the family know military service was very important to their loved one, but as they bring his body home, it seems insensitive as opposed to comforting, and both Kelly and Trump use those words. And from Rebecca on General Kelly, please stop making excuses for John Kelly. Did anybody here remember making excuses?
So.
Okay. Please stop making excuses for John Kelly. He allowed his son's death to be politicized by the president. He threw the Khan family, the Gold Star family that spoke at the Democratic Convention, under the bus yesterday. He spoke about women once being honored. He defended a man who bragged about grabbing women by, quote, the you-know-what, my protection of our license.
We know.
He was brutal as head of the Department of Homeland Security, which saw the ramp up of ICE activities. Mm-hmm. Although our political pundits praised him as a grown-up, he's not going to save us, and that's Rebecca. Okay, thank you, Rebecca. Good morning, panel, says our friend Julius. President Trump is incapable of compassion and empathy. It's all about him. Any attempt at expressing empathy and compassion comes off as clumsy and terribly insincere. That's from our friend Jules. Tim says, why did General Kelly feel the need to critique the Khan family who spoke out at last year's convention? Does anybody remember?
Yes,
he did.
Spoke at the convention and the president.
No, I remember that.
Did Kelly talk about that yesterday?
He did?
I don't know. I didn't hear
yes,
that.
Yes, he did. He talked about why was this brought up. But what I was he was saying that it was undignified, that he didn't think there were certain lines that he think would ever be crossed, and it was about how this was raised at the convention, and then he talked about women, just what you're saying there.
Yeah.
But I wasn't clear if he was upset about Trump going after the Khan family
family.
I thought he was pretty vague about that.
Yeah, because it almost seemed like, because it was Trump who brought it up, so it mm-hmm. certainly seemed that was where he was going, but I don't know.
But if you want to listen to Lawrence O'Donnell last night. The Last Word, he took this apart bit by bit. And
apparently, I didn't see it, of course, because I was asleep, but apparently made a reference to the Kelly family being in the same place as the congresswoman's family. Now, I may have that wrong, and that there may have been some traces of not pleasant racism involved in this. So,
well, he brought it because both he and Lawrence O'Donnell and General Kelly grew up in the Boston area.
Oh, Lawrence O'Donnell. I'm sorry, I got that wrong.
Lawrence
you,
O'Donnell.
Yeah.
In different neighborhoods, but both grew up in a time, and he talked about how the congresswoman grew up in a time where, in Florida, where schools were desegregated, and that he and the general grew up in Boston in a time where they weren't legally segregated, but segregated in fact. And
that's why I love you, Teresa, because no matter what kind of wrong information I give, you're always there to make it better, and you are.
She's a human fact checker.
Thank you.
A walking fact checker.
Thank you.
Everybody needs to listen to this piece.
And so there was Tim, who talked about the Khan family. Okay. And Roger says, with the controversy, presidential interactions with families of U.S. military killed in action, little has been focused on Niger. According to New York Magazine, there are about 800 troops in the country, a transit path for weapons and troops from the north to sub-Saharan Africa, and seen as helping Boko Haram in Nigeria, is seen as a crucial link in the war on terrorism. Senator McCain is now pushing for more information on our involvement in this region, something the American public knows almost nothing about. And that's from Roger. Steve says, Trump and Kelly, I would expect no more from this reality star. I feel badly for General Kelly. I have no doubt Kelly schooled Trump on how to make this most difficult call, and the prejudiced narcissist is incapable of the empathy required. The privileged draft dodger in chief has no clue. Increasingly disgusted, Steve in Pittsfield. And Michael says, on the Iran treaty, what is it about the Iran treaty that requires the president to recertify the treaty every 90 days? We lots of other treaties that don't require certification. See, now that's a pretty good example, Joe, of what you've been cautioning about on the letters. Read your letters and make sure nothing has been taken out. So it's, we have lots of treaties that don't require recertification.
That's right. Okay. Just pre-read them for our protection.
Joe is begging you.
Well, Alan is,
but
too.
That treaty does require recertification. Mm-hmm. Some do, some don't. That one does.
Okay. Isn't this recertification just something the Republican Congress came up with to make things difficult for President Obama after he negotiated the Iran treaty? Now the shoe is on the other foot, and that's Mike. Okay.
Yes, Mike.
And Kathy says, titles. Disturbs me to hear journalists and celebrities refer to President as Mr. Trump. He is the current sitting president of the United States and should be referred to by his title president, regardless of whether we individually agree with his actions. Please use his appropriate title.
Okay.
Okay.
I agree.
Yeah. I don't know that. Mm-hmm. Who?
The reporters call him Mr. Trump.
Oh, okay.
Just like they called him Obama. Trump, I think you call him president.
Trump's remarks to Widow. Trump obviously knew what a person who enlists was, quote, getting into. He got 3 or 4 draft deferments. If he had served in the military, he would know how horrible fighting is on fighters and their families, and that's from Claude in Albany. And Jay says, good morning. I hope you will dedicate more time this morning to what President Obama and President Bush had to say yesterday than what Richard Spencer said. People like him thrive on having an audience, so let's not provide one for him. Looking forward to a great show, and that's from Jay. Well,
we didn't mention Richard Spencer at all.
Not yet.
Nor did we want to.
No, we didn't even have it on the list, so that's all right.
But it did cost the university $500,000.
Yeah, $600,000.
$600,000.
Just for the added security that they needed at the place. You're exactly right.
And we do have the other stories on our agenda, so thank you very much.
Let's move right on.
What was the timestamp on that letter?
The timestamp on that letter... Time, 9:14 a.m.
Oh, well, for God's sakes, we hadn't even started the show yet.
Give us a break.
They were open. Just trying to set the agenda.
Good Lord.
Okay.
All right, keep going. Elizabeth said,
David Johnson, now that General Kelly has eloquently defended Trump's use of the term, he knew what he signed up for. Let us not forget that Trump denied saying it and that the congresswoman had, quote, fabricated it and that he never said any such thing.
I totally agree. That was my point.
It was, and you made it.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Definitely.
Early and well.
Elizabeth gets me.
Yes. And Robert says...
Good place to be.
Good morning. Of course Trump botched conveying an empathy he doesn't feel when he called Sergeant Johnson's grieving widow. Nonetheless, he tried, and one has to wonder why a congresswoman decided to publicly berate him for his tepid attempt. I have to agree with Kelly on this one. She was, in capital letters, grandstanding for personal aggrandizement.
No, she, in fact, twice tried to say, let's move on. She has said, let's move on. Let's focus on what matters. And then the White House ramps it up again.
Well, again, I want to go back to my point that this is a not only a congressperson, but a woman and a black woman. And that's the signal that is being sent out from President, excuse me, I've got to clear my throat here, President Trump is that, you know, black people are to be made fun of or disregarded. That's what I'm thinking here.
Apropos of nothing, I learned that she wears hats all the time, which I knew, but
yeah.
In honor of her grandmother.
Who wore hats?
The congresswoman, African-American, but because of the fact that, you know, her grandmother grew up in segregation, would not be able to, how amazing it is that she was able to get this far as an African-American woman. So to never forget how far she's come and what it would have mean to her grandmother, because her grandmother always wore hats.
And one last letter here from C. Eric, who says, "The fancy Senate offices are suites, and the gym health facilities downstairs are spa-like. They don't suffer." Now, Teresa, both
That's
you and I,
not true.
both
sorry.
You and I work in the Congress, and that is exactly right. And when you're a speaker, you have offices all over the place. You have one in the Capitol itself. You have one in the Rayburn Office Building, and anything else you might want. You really are a potentate.
Speaker,
but if you're not the speaker,
the speaker is different. I mean, they have like working fireplaces, but the rank and file. If you're, you know, a junior Congress member, it's a tiny little.
It's a
tight.
Well,
it depends on who you are.
I mean, you are one on top of. It's a very tight quarters. It's,
sometimes literally.
Well, when my congressman, the guy that I work for, moved from Cannon to Rayburn, Rayburn was terrific.
The halls are wider. Yeah.
Well, no, the offices were extraordinary.
Yes, they are. They were. As you grow and rise in seniority, the offices get bigger, but.
Yeah, you have to bid on the offices.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get to many other topics of the day. We have a lot to discuss. We want to talk about the EPA. We want to talk about Puerto Rico. We want to talk about the tax cut plan and much, much more. We'll get to all of that stuff. And we'll do that right after this break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A great pleasure to be with you, and so glad that you are spending a few moments of your day with us as we grapple with what's going on in our world. Alan Chartok is here, Judith Enck, Aaron Pasitti, Teresa Bourgeois. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. You know, where we get letters like this.
Like this. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
And this is from Deanne, who's a wonderful woman and been a big writer to the show. I love the show. Would you please talk about this budget the Republicans are trying to pass, as well as they're changing the voting rules so they can pass it? Thank you. And that's from Deanne. Okay. And there we are. Let's talk about it.
Okay. So we're going to put Mr. or Professor Pasitti on the hot seat here to describe exactly what happened when it comes to the Senate Republicans approving a budget with $1.5 trillion deficit to pay for Trump's tax cuts. Now, what?
That's the big news. So there's the cuts to Medicare, Medicaid. There's all of these other things that are in this, you know, almost $4 trillion budget. The big news is the tax plan. And to call it a tax plan at this point is being a little disingenuous, because it's an outline of something that may or may not become a tax plan. It's a very skeletal, probably one or two page document that is consolidating tax rates, talking about getting rid of some loopholes, cutting the corporate tax rate. So Trump has lied consistently about the United States being a high tax country relative to, all industrialized countries in the world. The United States is well below average. So if you look at the 35% corporate tax rate now, that's the sticker tax rate. You know, Apple and Google pay 1 or 2% in tax rates. There's
GE
all these exemptions.
Pays nothing.
There's all of these loopholes. So just to say, well, we have the highest tax rate in the world, doesn't matter. What you need to look at is the percentage of taxes paid as a share of the overall economy. But back to his tax plan. It's projected to add $1.5 trillion to the deficit over the next decade. And if I remember correctly, when Obama was in office and was trying to pass a stimulus plan that was half that size, everybody was screaming bloody murder about the size of the deficit. So when it's tax cuts for the wealthy, deficits are fine. So I really like Paul Krugman's phrase calling Republicans deficit peacocks. They're not hawks about deficits, because when their party is passing something like the Bush tax cuts or the Reagan tax cuts that will completely bust the budget, it's okay. But the tax cut itself, unsurprisingly, is very heavily tilted towards the wealthy, in that somebody in the top 1% of the income distribution, so you're talking about millionaires, is going to get an average tax break of $200,000. So that's a 20% increase in their after-tax income. If you look at the average middle-class family, you know, somebody who's earning around $60,000, it'll be about a 1% increase in their overall income.
Increase.
So everybody's getting a tax cut. Yeah. It's just that 80% of the tax cuts go to the top 1% of the income distribution, mm-hmm. and the rest of the population fights over the scraps. Mm-hmm. So why this is important and why these tax cuts are really just redistribution of income from middle-class families to millionaires is this. The argument for these supply-side tax cuts or trickle-down economics or Reaganomics is that, well, if you give the wealthy more money, they will use that to invest. They'll use that to hire new workers. Mm. Unemployment rate falls and the economy starts booming.
Which we already know doesn't work.
Right. Mm-hmm. But that's the assumption. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the reason why it doesn't work is that when, first of all, wealthy individuals don't hire workers. Businesses hire workers. So giving tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires just increases their incomes. And relative to middle-class families, upper income groups spend a lower percentage of their income than middle-class families. So a $2,000 tax break to a middle-class family will probably all get spent and actually increase economic activity, where a $2,000 tax break to a millionaire isn't going to make much of a difference. Mm. So they tend to save that money instead of spending it. So this tax plan is going to do absolutely nothing to stimulate economic growth. If anything, it'll probably decrease the you know, economic activity in the U.S. And it's a straight up transfer of income and wealth from middle class families to millionaires and billionaires.
Yes, but it doesn't it look to you, Professor, with a capital P, doesn't it look to you as if they've got the Republicans are going to hold together and have the vote, with the exception of Rand Paul? They all voted for it. Yeah. Including the ones who we had counted on to put a stop to some of the insanity over health care. Right. And so mm-hmm. it does look, and there will be some Democrats, some blue dog Democrats, who are going to go along with this because, you know, people can't look beyond the words tax cut.
Right. Right. The word tax cut has taken on this mythical connotation that, you know, tax cuts are always good. They always help economic growth. You can look at Reagan's tax cut. You can look at Bush's tax cut, and none of them did anything to materially increase economic growth.
And there's a
history that we can look at here. And if you look at Kennedy's tax cut back in the early 60s, that was primarily tilted towards middle class and upper middle class families. And what happened was the economy boomed after that.
And I would add, the first major legislation that President Obama got through Congress was his stimulus package, mm-hmm. the ARRA. That was not a tax cut. That did stimulate the economy. There were massive investments in public works projects, transportation. That created jobs. That got some sustained economic growth.
And for all those who say, well, you're just a bunch of lefties going to go after Trump for anything he does, Bruce Bartlett, the Republican, you want to talk about him?
Yeah. You can go.
He was Reagan's guy who was the lead architect of this trickle-down plan in the Reagan years. And he's come out repeatedly now and said, he's a Republican, that this will not work, that we learned that it did not work. You should not do this.
Well, President Trump doesn't care, you know, about that. And so the question that I'm going to raise with all of you is, what about upper middle class, middle class, upper lower middle Medicare? I mean, I get the fact that he's going to go after Medicaid. His cynicalness is they're poor, they don't vote,
they're nursing home residents.
What'd you say?
But in fact, I know that that's what people say, but in fact, Medicaid, they're nursing home residents primarily.
No, I know that. But Medicare now, mm-hmm. that's a third rail. And I think that is, I was saying to you guys before that I think that's a give back. In other words, I think that gets thrown in.
If he does Medicare cuts, it's game over. I don't think this Congress will go for Medicare cuts.
But my mom in Florida used
to sit. My mom in Florida used to sit next to that. She retired as a teacher very early. Her pension, she thought it was a fortune, was $16,000 a year. She would stand by that by the mailbox. And if that Social Security check didn't show up, and it was not a lot of money, she got on the phone the day she thought it should be there, mm-hmm. and she'd call them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people rely on that.
All right. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I do want to get to...
Can I just compliment Aaron for what he did?
Absolutely.
For his explanation of what happened. It was very clear. And
thank you
for that. Aaron.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Professor.
I'm kind of getting sick of saying it, but it's so important that people just don't learn from history about
stuff
like this.
We can get academic credit for listening to Aaron.
It was very good.
There will be an exam after
I'll buy you
the
a
show's
beer this
over.
Weekend.
Great. Sounds like a plan.
We want to get to I want to talk about the EPA. We should find out what's going on here. Scott Pruitt suggested he will restrict scientists who get EPA grants from advising the agency. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I want to shock you, Joe.
Okay.
I think it makes a little bit of sense.
Okay.
I am a good government geek, and I think if scientists apply and receive EPA grants, there might be a bias when they're supposed to be giving independent scientific assessment.
To then advise the agency.
Right. The practical problem then is, are the independent scientific advisory boards at EPA going to be dominated by scientists who just get industry grants and oil industry grants? I mean, the whole field of academic research is funded.
So that would be my guess, right?
Yeah, so I think he's kind of, there's a kernel of sensibility there, just a kernel, but you have to play it out. Who's going to wind up on these committees then?
But if I'm a scientist and I'm going for a grant from the EPA, eventually whatever I'm coming up with, perhaps environmentally, would then at some point in the food chain would hopefully go before the government that would enact it to allow that to be the law of the land or to be in somehow introduced into whatever protocol we're going
it's
with.
To inform regulatory
right.
decisions, policy decisions. Yep.
Okay, so if you then say well, then to your larger point, then who gets the grants and then what do you do with that information
and who are the advisors
and don't you want to engage the top people in the field?
Yes, absolutely. Well, yeah. And sadly it's almost a moot point because half of the EPA budget is for science, including very modest amounts of money on independent science advisory boards, very modest. There's hardly going to be a science component to the EPA. President Trump has proposed cutting the EPA budget by 31% and cutting the science budget by half. Administrator Pruitt, who I've said is the worst EPA administrator in the history of the agency, made this announcement at the Heritage Foundation. I think he's playing to his fossil fuel base. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I think there is a kernel of sensibility to it.
Okay. Also, in other environmental news, the President of the United States graded himself a 10 out of 10 for the response in Puerto Rico, and then turned to the governor of Puerto Rico pretty much with a gun to his head and said, oh, what grade would you give us?
Right. And what grade did he give him?
Well,
He didn't grade.
But he's very good, isn't he?
He's in a hard spot. He's a brand new governor. He just came into office in January.
He's a little conservative.
He's very conservative. The two governors in the territories, in both the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, they're in a tough spot because if they they publicly criticize the president. They're afraid they won't get enough federal funds to rebuild.
Yeah, he'll treat them even worse than he's treating them now, which is pretty bad.
Is that possible? I might add that, of course, the president gave himself a 10 out of 10. And this morning, one of my heroines, San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulin, gave the president a 1. I thought that was generous. But she, and I think closer to 1 is more accurate. I mean, the fundamental issue here is there's still so much suffering going on in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands.
And he's saying, we can't be here forever, says the president.
Yeah.
When 80% of the island is still without power.
Yeah. I mean, in St. John, which got hit by both hurricanes intensely, they have not had electricity for 43 days now.
And what's the percentage now that you just mentioned, Aaron, that's still left in Puerto Rico?
Well, 80%.
That's what I
mean. Yeah. And last night, electricity went out in parts of San Juan that had it for a while. So, you know, I also want to call on people in the media to stop asking the president questions to rate yourself on 1 to 10, because he always says 10. I mean, it could be the worst thing, and he's going to say
it's
he's a 10.
Factor.
He's not the most self-reflective person.
No.
And
you know, this when last time I was here in the studio, I said, you know, this Puerto Rico Virgin Islands situation is just beginning. I'll say that again. They're not going to have electricity on till next year. Imagine living your life every day, and it's really hot there. No electricity, no easy access to water. A third of the sewage treatment plants in Puerto Rico are not functioning. A lot of places still won't take credit cards. You can only operate with cash, and people don't have cash. It is a crisis.
And what are the health implications of this water situation? That, to me, is so
enormous. And the reason why a lot of the drinking water facilities and the sewage treatment plants are not working is because they don't have electricity. So I just want to make a quick point that when rebuilding happens, it has to be based on a very different electricity system. Right now, it's a decrepit old grid. It's not reliable. It's mostly burning imported oil and diesel. What I'm really focused on now is trying to get the Caribbean to rebuild with decentralized, renewable, resilient energy. And the really troubling thing is FEMA will not allow for that. FEMA rules are you only rebuild what was damaged in the storm. So the federal government will spend hundreds of millions of our tax dollars putting up a rickety old grid that's fossil fuel based. So we need Congress to step in and say, no, this will all come down in the next storm if we don't rebuild the electricity grid in a more resilient way.
I want to, we want to get to some letters. I want to go to just mention what President Bush said yesterday. President Bush was in New York City and spoke about the perils facing U.S. democracy. And here's a guy who basically has been out of the spotlight for 9 years, hasn't said a whole lot when it comes to presidential politics. Mm-hmm. And never criticize his immediate successor, President Obama. Yesterday at the George W. Bush Institute event in New York, he said, bigotry seems emboldened. Our politics seem more vulnerable to conspiracy theories and outright fabrication. We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism. We've seen our discourse degraded by casual cruelty. Argument turns too easily into animosity. It means that bigotry and white supremacy in any form is blasphemy against the American creed, and it means the very identity of our nation depends on passing along civic ideals. When did anyone in this room think that you would take a George W. Bush quote and put on your refrigerator?
It was terrific. I mean, he also said that what's going on today compromises the moral education of children.
Yes, but when he goes that far, you know things are really bad.
Right.
And that this country is in bad shape, and that both he and Obama are saying at this stage of the game, who really have been obeying the rules of the road, which is stay out of it,
right,
that this justifies our speaking out because it's the only way that we can be responsible citizens. Things are so bad that we have to say something.
And also the interesting friendship between the two of them, between Obama and Bush.
And Clinton, too, by the way.
And Clinton and their sort of universal— language on this is interesting.
And we need them all to speak out more. I mean, I think all political norms are gone now. And so I think we need this fraternity, because it's not a sorority. We need this fraternity of former presidents publicly speaking out. It's urgent.
And yet, the whole point of President Trump is that that this is the establishment, you see? So when all of these guys get together and do this to him, he says, see, the establishment is after me.
Aaron? So part of this, I mean, so Bush also said that that there is the growing inability and even unwillingness to separate truth from lies. That's a little disingenuous coming from a man who coming from a former president who led us into a war that's still going on under completely false pretenses, past $2 trillion tax cuts that had absolutely the opposite effect as he predicted. And politicians lie all the time, but we're still stuck in that morass in the Middle East, and those tax cuts are still a big drain on the federal budget deficit.
Thank you for bringing us back to reality.
But Alan, I mean, you've been a watcher of this for a long, long time. You had two presidents. You had ex-presidents. You had Bush in New York, and then you had President Obama last night in Richmond, Virginia. And then you also had Senator John McCain when he received the Liberty Medal in Philadelphia. And in a sense, House Speaker Ryan, he had a lot to say amidst those jokes last night at the Alfred E. Smith dinner. So you have three Republicans and a Democrat really going after this president. Have you seen anything like that?
No. No, I think this is the low point in American history, and that's inclusive of every president and everybody who's ever been here. I think we are now at a point of absolute crisis. We have a guy who is potentially going to get us into a nuclear confrontation, which we don't need, obviously, because nobody wins on something like that.
Heading to China soon, too.
What'd you say?
He's heading to China and to Asia soon, too.
Yeah.
Well, the sad reality also is it gets worse every month. It gets worse every week. I mean,
it,
you know, in the beginning, you were bracing yourself and hoping he'll grow into the job. He'll have good advisors. You look back over the last 9-10 months, it continues to get worse.
You have
how do we survive this?
Yeah. No. How do we survive? We have all these psychiatrists who've gotten together. And very unusually, because usually they don't do this kind of thing.
About 10 seconds.
So the guy is really has a problem.
We're going to end there, unfortunately. We are out of time. My thanks to Alan and Judith and Aaron and Teresa. Thank you all very much. Have a beautiful weekend. Thanks for being here.
Now that we've depressed you.
Yeah, go back.
Watch the meteor shower.
We'll be back after this.